Dr. Chris White from White Labs joins me to discuss efforts to unlock the genetic code of yeast. This is Beersmith Podcast number 131.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 131, and it's early August 2016. Chris White, the head of White Labs, joins me this week to discuss efforts to unlock the genetic code of brewing yeast. I'm pleased to announce the Beersmith 2.3 desktop was just released. It's a free update for all 2.x owners, and you can get it from the download page at beersmith.com. I've been doing a series of blog posts about the new features on the blog at beersmith.com/blog. Thank you to this week's sponsor, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're running an amazing deal right now, only $19.99 for a year-long subscription or $17.99 for the digital edition. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers, and I've started writing a question and answer column for them. Take advantage of their special deal now at beerandbrewing.com. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also Anvil, a new line of affordable brewing equipment from Blickman Engineering. This week, we're highlighting Anvil's Ferment in the Kettle Kit that converts your Anvil kettle into a fermenter. It comes with a silicone lid seal for the perfect fit, and you can use your Anvil dip tube as a sediment-free racking cane. Ferment and brew in a single kettle with Anvil. Learn more about Anvil at anvilbrewing.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Dr. Chris White. Chris is the president of White Labs, Inc., a top provider of brewing yeast worldwide, as well as the 2015 winner of the AHA Governing Committee Award for Lifetime Achievement in Brewing. He's also the author of the book Yeast, which is the Bible for brewing yeast. Chris, it is fantastic to have you back on the show.
Hi, great. It's great to be here. Thanks.
So how are you doing today? You said you just got back from a trip, I guess?
Well, yeah, I was at the Mammoth Beer Festival in Mammoth, California. They go there almost each August for this beer festival they put on, and it's about 6 hours from Southern California, about 6 hours from the Bay Area. So it's kind of in the Middle East, Eastern Sierras, and it attracts a lot of breweries from all over California. So
did you find any good beer there? That's the key question.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Lots of great beers, lots of new breweries. You know, I mean, it's amazing. I can find breweries at festivals that I've never heard of before, but that's just how, you know, the industry's growing so much. It used to be you'd hear about a new brewery for a little while and, you know, a few new ones would pop up here and there, but now it's, you know, every day. So
yeah, I think we're up close to 4,000 now, and I haven't been able to track them all for quite some time, actually. It's
tough. No, even, yeah, where I live in San Diego or Davis, I'm in Davis today, and I saw that there was a new brewery here last night when I got in town. So it's really incredible what's happening, and it's been going on for a few years now. You know, it kind of started in 2009, and it's just going. So
nice. Well, you had an interesting presentation this year at the HomebrewCon about unlocking the genetic code of brewing yeast. How'd you get started on the genetics of beer yeast?
Well, I've always been interested in genetics. It's what kind of drew me to science in the beginning. I, for whatever reason, I have an identical twin brother, Mike, you know, some people know because he works at White Labs. Then maybe that was part of the interest. But I was really interested, you know, how DNA can this make who we are and have, you know, some of the traits and things people don't even think about that are part of our genetic code. So that's, you know, that's kind of what led me from chemistry to biochemistry. And I started working with DNA, you know, while I was getting my PhD. So when I started working with brewer's yeast and started White Labs to work with brewer's yeast, I was always interested in if we could unlock the genetic code of brewer's yeast, because that would help us understand what they do. And there's a lot of biotech community here in San Diego, and lots of other people were interested in that too.
Cool. Now I understand that yeast is a single-celled form of fungi that was one of the first genomes to be fully sequenced way back in 1996. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, there was an interest in sequencing the full human genome. And for similar reasons why we want to sequence the yeast genome. I mean, but on a more human disease standpoint, if you could understand human genes, you could understand maybe why some diseases are happening and how to prevent them. So as a part of the human genome sequencing project, they needed to sequence a eukaryotic organism first, and they chose yeast because yeast had been such a lab organism since science began, probably because we have used it so much in brewing. But a few things had already been sequenced, a few bacteria and very simple organisms, but eukaryotic organism with a nucleus holding the DNA and all of the chromosomes, that hadn't been done yet. So yeah, 1996, Saccharomyces cerevisiae was the first eukaryotic organism to be sequenced. And that sounded great at the time. It did lead to a few years later of the human genome being sequenced because the tools created for that. But brewers didn't learn a whole lot out of that because it wasn't brewers' strains of Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which are really different than the lab strains. A lot more DNA and mutations and things that aren't in Saccharomyces cerevisiae lab strains.
So, Chris, we've made some advancement in understanding the genes of humans, obviously. And can you tell us a little bit about how that relates to sequencing yeast or sequencing yeast, I should say?
Well, it actually did lead to a lot of understanding of again, human diseases, and that there are genes that are involved in lots of diseases that people never thought of, such as diabetes and things when you think of environmental factors. But there's genes involved. And so now you can look and see if you have genetic markers for these diseases. It doesn't mean that you're going to get those diseases. Usually you have some kind of genetic marker, meaning mutation or something that might cause a disease, but then there has to be some other environmental factor or something that happens to you that triggers that. So it's a little controversial, but you can send your DNA into companies like 23andMe and use the machines that we just used to sequence brewer's yeast, and you can see if you have some of these genetic markers. But the FDA is a little concerned about that because it doesn't mean you're going to get those diseases. but some other things that happen from it that weren't expected, whatever, is just understanding human evolution and understanding more about what we are because of the understanding of DNA. For example, we didn't think that Homo sapiens, the only surviving species of humans, ever mated with other species of humans, such as Neanderthals, which is Homo, the same genus. But they died out and Homo sapiens survived. But it turns out after sequencing DNA and then looking at it, there is Neanderthal DNA in a lot of humans. So humans did, Homo sapiens did mate with Neanderthals coming out of Africa. So that's something that people never knew of, but it also explains some of the allergies and other things that some people have and others don't because of what's in the Neanderthal DNA. And then every week there's some new species or organism being sequenced that we learn a lot more about.
And this ties back to yeast, too, because we can track where our yeast came from, potentially, or the history of the yeast, right?
Exactly, because through genetic changes, when you're looking at organism to organism to organism, it helps you tie back how far those might have happened or how closely they related organisms might be. Because with brewer's yeast, I mean, there's no fossil record to know with single-cell organisms like that have been or... you know, the current debate about maybe lager yeast and how it came about and how long it's been used rather than ale yeast, which we know is a lot longer history. These are some of the things will help the full genome sequence will help to solve.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about the history of yeast? Yeast itself wasn't well understood until the 18th and 19th centuries, right?
Right. Brewers were brewing from way before written history. So it's the difficulty to calculate when we started making beer. But we know that people settled and started making beer in Mesopotamia, present day kind of Iraq area, and using barley that they had planted, water. And then that brewing tradition or that really heavy interest in brewing kind of moved to Europe at some point. And then Europe became the center for brewing throughout the Middle Ages. And it was a great way to purify the water, basically, through the fermentation. And it tasted good, and people enjoyed the feeling. So beer became very popular in Europe. And the whole time they were using yeast.
But they didn't know it, right?
Right. They didn't know it. They were using yeast, and no one knew that, of course, even when the famous one is the German purity law, Reinheitsgebot, they in the 16th century, they said, okay, you have to use barley and hops and water, barley, hops, and water. No mention of yeast, even, of course, they were using it. So it took until the 19th century, Louis Pasteur, 1860s, he was already famous. He's the one who kind of finally sealed the debate that yeast causes fermentation. Yeast is alive. That was also debated, right? Because you look at yeast, beer under a microscope, there's all sorts of things in there. It's hard to proteins and other things. It's hard to tell what's alive. Yeast doesn't really look alive. So it took a lot of science. And that was kind of the early science with brewer's yeast. It was something people could work with. And so they were able to prove that brewer's yeast causes fermentations. And then a few years later, in the 1880s, it was purified. And then the first beers that were made with purified lager yeast were brewed in Carlsberg in 1883.
So beers before that were primarily made with wild yeast, right?
They were brewer's yeast, but they were mixtures of yeast. So we don't really know when all these great traits of brewer's yeast became part of brewer's yeast, but it happened when it started to be reused. So wild yeast certainly causes fermentation when everybody just, you know, when people had open fermenters, and I'm sure in Sumeria and Mesopotamia and things like that, they probably were having open fermentations and lots of wild kind of fermentations. But in Europe, the belief is around the Middle Ages, sometime early Middle Ages, people started reusing yeast. And so as they started reusing yeast, they were training it to do what brewers wanted, to ferment fast, to taste good, to make alcohol, of course. And so they built these traits into brewer's yeast by reusing and reusing and reusing. It was just mixtures of yeast, because if you didn't know what it was, of course, you weren't purifying it. You didn't even know you were causing these changes, or basically domesticating brewer's yeast, but they were, by reusing it, reusing it, reusing it.
So they were basically breeding it through selection, right? Selectively, exactly. Breeding it.
You know, a bad batch, don't reuse that yeast. Whatever they, you know, different words, every language had a different word for it. But in English, you know, in Britain, we know they called it God's good. And they would reuse it if it was good. So slowly they lost the phenol traits. Brewer's yeast makes phenols, like you taste in Weizens and Belgian style beers. But we know in pale ales and IPAs and things like that, that flavor isn't there. And that's a product of a mutation that was probably, you know, cultivated by brewers looking for those flavors, or tasting something and going, wow, this tastes a lot better than the last batch. I'll keep this one going.
Very cool. As I understand it, there's only a few species of yeast that are actually used in modern home brewing, right?
Right. You know, Saccharomyces is a big group, big genus, and there's lots of different species in there. So most of it is Saccharomyces cerevisiae, a little bit of Saccharomyces pasteurianus, which we call the lager yeast now. That has been kept as a separate species through kind of traditional nomenclature and rules about that. Sometimes that gets reshuffled once DNA sequencing is done. That happens throughout naming organisms.
That was a question I had. Is top fermenting and bottom fermenting yeast, are they actually the same, or are they different, or are they different species?
Well, I think they will stay different species, because there is a lot of what you would call foreign DNA if you were thinking Saccharomyces cerevisiae. So there is a big contingent of extra DNA in there that's not Saccharomyces cerevisiae, that has come from some other organism through hybridization, or, you know, another event. But a little of that already started being worked on before whole genome sequencing, because of the interest in lager yeast and the use of it worldwide. So we know that there's a few different types of Saccharomyces pasteurianus, for example, but we really still don't know when Saccharomyces pasteurianus happened. We don't know when in the caves of Bavaria somebody said, wow, this thing that we're fermenting cold that used to take weeks is done in days. It's kind of like probably what happened. And then they said, let's use this stuff that tastes good, and it fermented in days instead of weeks. And so that fostered the right environment for an hybridization to happen between Saccharomyces cerevisiae and another yeast in the area, another Saccharomyces possibly. And then there's lots of just different genus of yeast that are out there, from Pichia and others. Britannomyces is an example of another genus of yeast that's not, so it's yeast, but it's not Saccharomyces, it's Britannomyces with its all whole bunch of different species. And Britannomyces has just been something that's been around because it's much more prevalent than Saccharomyces cerevisiae. It lives in the wild really easily, and it does okay in beer because it's really, really slow grower, and it's often missed, and it's hard to clean, especially when people don't know how to clean. So it's been a part of our beers for a long time. After Louis Pasteur said, hey, that yeast causes fermentation, these other organisms cause the off flavors, brewers started cleaning. And after they were cleaning for over 100 years, we got rid of Britannomyces for the most part.
Not but I would assume that most most beers early on, all of them had Britannomyces, right?
Oh yeah, probably until the 1950s. I mean, it was dwindling. But you know, I think reading descriptions and hearing stories from authors like Michael Jackson past, it sounds like you know, beers, especially in Britain, still had Britannomyces character in them, and that makes sense because they were not as fast to clean up their breweries in Britain as maybe Central Europe and Northern Europe did. So the the question of Britannomyces, I mean, even the wine industry in the 1970s still had a lot of Britannomyces, and there's a lot less of it now because it's just a factor of cleaning, but you got to know what to clean and how to clean and get a whole industry behind it.
And also, obviously, being able to work with a single strain of yeast, we've got pure yeast cultures now, which they certainly didn't have in the past, right?
Oh, yeah. And the whole idea of a pure yeast culture is almost a little funny. You know, you think about it. I mean, we think of mixed cultures as unusual in our industry. Oh, a mixed culture. But that's the norm, right? That's the world. To pluck one single strain out of a mixed culture in the environment and use it and keep it pure sounds impossible, actually, to a microbiologist. But brewers did it. And brewers did it because the beer tasted cleaner, was more consistent. They knew what they got batch after batch after batch. But that makes us kind of unusual as an industry for doing that.
And when did that happen? When did we start using single strain yeast or started isolating them?
That interest in that, it happened right after Louis Pasteur, you know, kind of published his work that said yeast causes fermentation. This is it. This is final. This is not, this is fact. And so some breweries jumped right on that idea. But it wasn't easy to purify the yeast. I mean, some of the tools of microbiology, you know, weren't even invented. That was just one of those early statements in microbiology that, hey, yeast causes fermentation. So you imagine the 1860s wasn't a very clean and sanitary place anywhere. But in about 20 years, it was purified in Copenhagen by the Carlsberg Breweries, Emil Christian Hansen's lab. So that was 1883.
That's pretty amazing. So that was quite a long time ago now.
Yeah, it was a long time ago, but not a long time ago because, I mean, a lot hasn't really changed for how we do brewer's yeast. It got purified and we said, great. And we're using it that way. We understand the traits, but still not a lot of molecular biology has gotten applied to brewer's yeast yet. It's what's surprising to me is how quickly pure culture spread. You know, 1883 was the beginning, and shortly after, brewers throughout Europe were using pure cultures because the beer was so much better. Oh, it was lager yeast, and some people had to make a switch. But you can imagine with a pure culture, it was just way more consistent if you were selling beer. And Carlsberg freely gave out these pure cultures. They wanted better beer to spread, I think, similar to craft brewers today, saying, hey, I want my neighbor to make better beer so the public has good beer. So they gave it to anybody who asked.
That's awesome. Now, we've been talking a lot about species and strains, but a species can have many, many different strains. Can you talk about what's meant by a strain of yeast? Because most of us now in the homebrew world certainly work with strains, right?
Right. We work with strains. And I guess one way to compare that against with humans, we're all Homo sapiens. but we're different strains, right? I'm a different strain than you, Brad. And but we just don't have the ability to.
I would hope so.
So since we're so big, we can see each other. We know what the differences from, if you called us strains, would be. But we don't have the ability to duplicate ourselves, clone ourselves. So brewer's yeast on that level. So brewer's yeast are different individuals, different strains. But since brewer's yeast doesn't mate, they clone themselves. So that different individual is perpetually different. And that strain, we can keep that line going by its cloning. So only the small mutations that build up are what changes them. But you can imagine if brewer's yeast mated in our fermenter, we'd get new yeast out of every batch.
So, I mean, these are single-celled organisms that split, right, basically, mm-hmm. to reproduce. How do you get new DNA or new sequences introduced into it?
Well, it's difficult, and it hasn't really been done in the lab. Yeast that brewers use have been created in breweries.
So how do you get new strains, though? I mean, how does that happen naturally?
Time, breweries. There's, you know, hundreds of different strains out there, maybe more. That maybe into the thousands, but it's usually, we're talking numbers under about 1,000 of these stable different strains that were created in breweries worldwide over hundreds of years in different conditions. And that has been able to be replicated over time. And so we are really living in a short time. So we might not see new yeast strains or only a few created in our lifetimes. Because it took so long to get here.
I assume they happen when it splits and something goes wrong, right?
Right. Fragments of chromosomes don't get replicated. There's changeover between chromosomes that causes mutations. Basically, when yeast is trying to adapt to some conditions, they'll mutate. And mutations are very common in nature. Like I was talking about Brettanomyces or something, they'll change all the time. But brewer's yeast has all this DNA in there. Again, it's a trait that was done by brewers, because the more stable, more DNA inside of a yeast, the more stable it's going to be. Because if there's a mutation on one chromosome, there'll be another one that's still making that protein product. So we kind of built this stability into brewer's yeast by selecting the strains that were really stable. And since they also lost the ability to sporulate, to make spores, so that's the mating cycle. So that's why they lost the ability to mate.
Well, I noticed as you've been sequencing these different yeasts, you've actually started to group them into different groups. Can you tell us a little bit about those groups?
Yeah, that'll be published pretty soon. The paper was accepted in Cell, and it's just making its way through that process to know when it's going to be out. But that has come out since the AHA conference, so we're happy about that. So people will get to see all the charts and paper pretty soon. But what we were able to do genetically is put yeast in groups, and they're phylogenetic trees. So they're genetics with the with what they do. And so there's groupings. When we found, it's pretty interesting, you know, we make these big phylogenetic trees that show that there's an ale group one, there's an ale group two. And the ale group two is much more similar to the wine yeast.
And I assume these probably had different heritages, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And you can tell that because, you know, you have in the center of these charts would be the beginning of yeast, for example. And then as you go outside of the chart, as you get outside of that circle, you have more and more genetic differences. And so that's how they get put around this wheel of this phylogenetic tree. And so ones that are very far apart from each other are very genetically different. Ones that are very close to each other are very genetically similar. So you can see how similar strains are from our list of California ale yeast to English ale yeast to Kolsch yeast to wine strains. And they're all on this phylogenetic tree. And then we'll say, you know, well, we'll be able to show you which ones they are. Once that publication comes out. But we also added other strains. There's about 200 strains that we did in part of the study, because it was a big collaboration with other people in San Diego, with a lab in Belgium. We're just lucky that it got kind of started in San Diego, because we have a tasting room there and we have people that are interested in genetics, and a company called Illumina in town that makes these high throughput sequencing machines.
And I should mention, you have those AHA slides are available for folks that are members of the AHA. You can get to them from the AHA website, right?
Oh, yeah. Perfect. Yeah. Yeah.
So, that's where you can see that wheel that we're talking about, if you will. But on it, I think it has baker's yeast, wine yeast, and other kinds of yeast as well, right?
Right. We included, about 100 strains from our, we started with 96 yeast strains, and people in science will kind of know what that means because you use a lot of 96 well plates. So that's why it's 96. So we started with 96 yeast strains, and on these plates, that's how you do the sequencing. And the sequencing happens very fast now. The data analysis takes years. So we've been working on this for a few years, but other people have. I mean, we supplied the strains and other things, but we haven't. A lot of other people are doing the work, including the lab in Belgium, that added another 100 strains. So that's why we got 200. And all Saccharomyces, so brewer's yeast, baker's yeast, wine yeast, cider yeast, sake yeast. It's exciting to see how they all lay out and how similar and different they really are genetically. Because you know they have been different from sensory. You know they have been different when you brew with them. And it's really exciting to see that that's mirrored by the genetics when you look at the genetics.
Well, that's actually what I wanted to go into next. You're obviously next trying to measure different traits, right? Different traits of the beer, for example, or different traits of the yeast, and tie that back to the genetic sequence. What are some of the traits that you're looking at measuring?
We measured so much, so many different traits, from alcohol production to maltose usage, temperature optimums, and the lab in Belgium had a nice little robotic unit that we could do many, many, many fermentations, and then we did some bigger ones in San Diego. But we're looking at all these traits, so that's where you tie these traits together with the genetics. And even if you say, if I said, hey, California ale yeast is this and this and this, and English ale yeast is this way, even without those descriptions, you can put them on a map by looking at what they actually do and their genetics and how similar they are. So, that's why we know, that's why there's this wine group too, because through what they do, they act more like the wine strains in terms of alcohol production. Alcohol production is grouped genetically, which is interesting. You know, is the ability to produce high alcohol beers an environmental aspect or a yeast aspect? And most people think it's some kind of yeast aspect. And sure enough, it groups genetically.
So high alcohol tolerance, for example, like wine, champagne yeast, and that kind of thing falls into that group, right?
Exactly. But most of those wine strains are not very good at maltose uptake. And they're generally phenolic. So phenolic is another trait we looked at. So if you, in the future, in the near future, I hope, if you can use some genetic information to say, look at some charts and say, hey, I want to make this high alcohol beer. Where is a high alcohol kind of genetic yeast that's phenolic negative and has good maltose uptake? And then you'd find a great strain to make a high alcohol beer.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. And you could pull that off your chart, right? Potentially.
Yeah, so that part could happen pretty quickly.
So what are some of the things you found regarding these different traits? We talked a little bit about the genetics, but I mean, what are some of the interesting findings you've had?
Interesting findings are that, there's a kind of a, I don't know, there's a lot of interesting findings, but one that I thought was interesting is there's kind of an Asian group of strains that has a phenolic mutation as well. It's the only other time there's been seen this phenolic mutation in the strains that we've looked at.
So does it mean it's phenolic positive or phenolic negative?
So phenolic is positive. Phenolic flavors are normal. So when I say there's a mutation, what I mean is there's that mutation in the phenolic production in the genes that produce the phenol. So ale strains have them. Lager strains have that mutation, which is interesting. So the hybridization of ale and lager yeast had happened, before the mutation. Well, not before, but it happened that ale yeast DNA that came over in Saccharomyces pastorianus had the mutation, the phenolic negative mutation. That's why lager yeast have the phenolic negative. So that lager yeast had the phenolic negative because it had Saccharomyces cerevisiae DNA in it, but that was used in brewing. But there's a separate event that happened with sake yeast, because sake yeast are also phenolic negative. And if anybody's brewed with them, they would kind of know that. But they sort of have to be phenolic negative. Otherwise, all your sake would taste phenolic because it's not distilled. when you distill something, the yeast can be phenolic producing. So a lot of distilled yeast produce phenols because they're such big and high molecular weight that they stay behind when you distill off the vapor, which containing the ethanol. So that's just sort of interesting that that we sort of knew they were phenolic negative, but that we can see genetically that it's a separate event that happened.
And I guess one of the other major findings, of course, we've already touched on it, is how humans have interacted to selectively really breed these different yeasts, right?
Right. So that's kind of what we're, the hypothesis in this paper, we're really trying to show with the, we didn't just do five strains or something. By doing 200, we're saying, look, here's the map of the genetics versus the phenotypes. That's the what they do part. So here's proof that humans domesticated brewer's yeast, that humans directed the evolution of these strains.
So they, so I mean, we played a role in selectively picking these for each role, for each type, whether it be used for wine or bread or whatever, right?
Right. We had a role in it. Now, bread yeast is, you know, people used to use brewer's yeast for bread, for example. So you're going to see some similar DNA in there. But people realize that you could, so you can't breed brewer's yeast. So very difficult to make more strains of baker's yeast. So they went to more laboratory type strains, similar to laboratory type strains that could be mated. So you baker's yeast has been made in different ways now through breeding, which just makes it more different than brewer's yeast. Yeah.
So, I mean, how does this all those genomes basically affect the future of yeast? I mean, what are you looking at in the future for developing new yeast strains?
Well, my main interest in working on this was to understand brewer's yeast better. And because I know how much we don't know about brewer's yeast because we don't know the genetics. And I think other people will see that too, that are, that like, wow, we didn't know all this stuff in a couple of years. Right. And that's the bridge I'm trying to get, done. And hopefully a lot of other labs will work on it. I mean, we're not a research lab. We don't have a lot of extra facilities. We have a little R&D program, but we're a small company and it was nice that other people worked with us to get this done. But I'm hoping, a lot of, good labs that are research based will start working on this, and maybe we can find ways to breed brewer's yeast. And if we can breed brewer's yeast, once knowing the traits, we can direct some breeding to some new and interesting strains. That's a non-GMO way of doing it, right? Certainly, with this information, you could maybe create some GMO strains, but that doesn't have to be the way it goes.
So currently, none of the brewer's yeast are genetically modified, though, right? There's no GMOs.
Right. No GMO yeast. And partly that's because they're so hard to make. You know, a lot of people ask me, why is there no GMO yeast? Well, it's mostly because the industry doesn't want them. And they're, you know, there's a consumer backlash, perhaps, that maybe not in the U.S., but beer is a worldwide beverage. And other countries such as, you know, in Europe, countries in Europe or Australia are really anti-GMO. But also, they're very, very difficult to make because of all that DNA in brewer's yeast. They're polyploid, and that's the word for having extra chromosomes. And that's what we show in this paper, too, because we can quantify that. But we, so they're difficult to make. Now, there have been some made. Including early on for light beer, but big brewers decided to just do it by the other methods, using enzymes and or long mashes and those cases to make light beer. But there's been yeast that's been made to consume starch, so you wouldn't have to do a mash. There's been lots of other kinds of genetically modified yeast that have been made but not used in brewing yet. So I mean,
it is possible, certainly.
Yeah, it's already possible. But knowing more information, I guess, about where the genes are and exactly what they do allows somebody who wants to do some splicing a little bit, you know, faster understanding of, okay, here's how I can make this genetically modified yeast. But they're still very hard to make in brewer's yeast since they don't spoil it.
And what is the breeding option? Can you explain that to us? Because, I mean, it's a single cell organism that splits. How do you actually breed it?
Well, most yeast, either breed or they clone themselves. It's still a cell dividing, but I mean, two cells come together and make a new cell, or one cell splits. So in Brewer's case, Saccharomyces cerevisiae's case, they can do either one.
So, I mean, you do have the option of modifying it through breeding, right?
But you, if they don't sporulate, they don't breed, they don't mate. So while Saccharomyces cerevisiae sporulates fine, and that's how new strains are made through breeding, the strains that we use for brewing, the brewing yeast of Saccharomyces cerevisiae, do not sporulate. Another mutation that was built up by brewers. So that prevents them from mating, and that prevents them from changing. And that makes it difficult if you now say, hey, I want to breed brewer's yeast as a brewer. We're going to have to figure out how to put that back in.
Well, can you sum up for us, Chris, what all this means for brewers potentially in the future?
I mean, what I hope it means is more information. It may later lead to more strains, but in the beginning, it's going to lead to more information. I mean, because the thing brewers are usually asking is, what yeast do I use for? And if you can, or they say, hey, your descriptions on your yeast aren't that big, you know, yeah, they're not. But if you can pair that with genetic information, then if we could add on some of the transcription information to the DNA information, meaning what is made from that DNA, that's why this is sort of just in the beginning, we can really get at exactly, you know, what strain you would want for a certain beer.
Very cool. Well, Chris, I wanted to ask you in closing, if there's anything you wanted to add, or if you want to say a little bit about some of the things going on at White Labs right now.
Oh boy, there's been a lot going on at White Labs. I've been a busy person.
There's your website.
Yeah, thank you. Mostly because of the 4,000 or so plus breweries out there, we have been building capacity to make more yeast, and we're trying to do it in a great way to even, you know, improve the yeast we produce. So we have a new process that we patented, the pure pitch package that you can see on the website.
Yeah,
that's been going out more and more for the last couple of years. It's been a long process because it's a difficult one.
I think I interviewed you, it was a little under 2 years ago when you were getting ready to launch them, if I recall.
Right. And we're still working on it every day. I mean, most of the homebrew yeast now are in pure pitch, except for some of the blends and stuff. So we're pretty much there, and it's great timing because we're building the new lab in Asheville, North Carolina. And one of the reasons, if you look back in the interview too, is why we went to the new process is I wanted a process I could duplicate better in another facility. So we started making yeast in Copenhagen last year using that process, and Asheville will open in October of this year. And when for yeast making anyway, and there's a whole expansion throughout the next year and a little tasting room that will go into Asheville. So we're working on that every day. I'm going out there next week to see some of the construction. We added for homebrewers, we added a section on the website called Yeast Vault, which is strange because people always ask us, how many strains do you have in the yeast bank? And, you know, it's 800 or so, and only 100 of them are available commercially. How do we get to those other strains? So that's why we call it kind of the vault, the strains of that deep vault. And we put them on, we put a few of them on the website. I think there's about 30 right now, and brewers can pre-order them, and that'll trigger a production run, and we'll make it. And eventually later, maybe that'll feed into some stores and commercial breweries. But right now, we just released it for home brewers, and we make the batch size that we get in the orders. So it uses some of the kind of crowdsourcing technology and gets us into that space a little bit.
So if I can get enough of my buddies together, we can have you run some of these for us?
Oh, yeah. There's already been about a half dozen. We started that in January that have been released, and homebrewers have received them. And if you're not looking at Vault, you wouldn't even know it because they don't end up in stores right now or anywhere else. So it's just it ends up on the doorstep of a homebrewer. then they've been making beers with them, and it's tied to different social media things and stuff like that too, to help get more people to, like, once you sign up, to get more people to sign up, because the faster it gets to that number, the quicker we'll produce it.
That's awesome. I wasn't even aware of that. And of course, Pure Pitch has been a big success, I think, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's been great. It's really started to do what we intended in 2009, because we have a lot of the machinery in place. Until we had a lot of the high speed machinery to do all the heat sealing, which was required. It was actually a pretty slow process, but now it's faster. Now, those machines are all manned by people, so it's a little bit more expensive to produce for us, actually, than the old way. But it's the yeast is in such better condition. We're okay with that. They breathe out the CO2 they can make inside of a package. So the shelf life is a lot longer. They haven't gone through any kind of packaging because they're encased in part of that material they grew in.
You grow them right in the package, right?
Yeah. Big, large reactors, and then they get smaller and smaller and smaller into either the commercial sizes you see there on the screen or the smaller homebrew sizes.
Very cool. Well, Chris, I wanted to thank you again for coming on the show. Really appreciate you being here.
It's a pleasure. Thanks. It's fun to talk about some of the things we're doing. And the DNA work, I think, is going to be exciting for the industry.
Well, thanks again to Chris White for joining me from White Labs. Chris is the president of White Labs and author of the book Yeast from the Brewers Association, which I should mention as well. Chris, thanks again.
Great. Thank you.
A big thank you to Chris White from White Labs for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. This month's issue features hoppy and mixed fermentation lagers. Take advantage of a fantastic sale and get a one-year subscription now to the magazine for only $19.99 from beerandbrewing.com. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also Anvil, an amazing line of affordable, durable brewing equipment from Lichtman Engineering. Get the Ferment in a Kettle kit that lets your Anvil kettle be used as a fermenter. You can see the full line of Anvil equipment at anvilbrewing.com. Again, that's anvilbrewing.com. And finally, a reminder to get the new Beersmith 2.3 desktop update. The world's top beer brewing software just got better, packed with new features like mash pH adjustment, simplified recipe editing, and much more. You can download it from beersmith.com or read about all the features on my blog at beersmith.com/blog. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.